Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
We also know that Congress intends to try to act quickly, but we also have a lot of concerns.
Elizabeth Swanson with Pinion at a recent Farm Foundation forum on taxes.
So first of all, the cost of the TCJA significantly higher than was originally estimated in 2017. The newest estimates that we've seen is that a full extension of the TCJA is going to cost $7.75 trillion through 2035. We've also heard indications that some of these tax changes won't have retroactive effect, meaning that some provisions that I'll get into in a minute that have already expired won't be fixed. And further, with the budget reconciliation process and the expected cost, we're worried that Congress is going to have to pick and choose which provisions of the TCJA are going to get extended.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
I did want to take a quick look back at the calendar year 2024 for drought. It was a bit of a roller coaster ride in terms of drought coverage during the year of 2024. We hit a four-year low in drought coverage back in June with under 12% of the country in drought on the 11th of June. And then just 4.5 months later, in late October, we reached our annual high, greater than 54% of the lower 48 states in drought on October 29th. So quite a swing from that four-year low to a two-year high in drought coverage from 12 to 54% between mid-June and late October.
The last U.S. drought monitor covering 2024 indicated
some improvement in the overall drought situation during the month of December.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says for the drought monitor for the period ending December 31st,
drought coverage across the lower 48 states just a shade over 38% of the country at the end of 2024. That is down from almost 44% at the beginning of December, and that's also down from our autumn peak and also our 2024 peak of just over 54% of the country back on October 29th.
And over 5.5% decrease in overall drought coverage month over month, and 60% decrease since the October peak. Drier conditions in the Southwest were offset by drought reductions and eradications in much of the eastern U.S.
As we take a look at some of our individual state numbers, I always like to focus on our two worst drought categories, extreme to exceptional drought, because those higher end droughts can have much more impactful effects on agriculture and other sectors of the economy. We saw parts of 17 states experiencing extreme and or exceptional drought, and a lot of that was focused across the Northern Plains and Northern Rockies, parts of the Southwest, and then just a few lingering pockets in the eastern United States. In the West, parts of 8 of our 11 Western states experiencing extreme or exceptional drought at the end of 2024, led by Wyoming, coming in at 26%. Now, as we move to the Great Plains, it's really Western and South Central Texas primarily, and then several pockets across the Northern Plains dealing with extreme to exceptional drought. In the East, we do have a couple of small areas of extreme drought continuing, mainly in Tennessee and the Northern Mid-Atlantic. New Jersey actually leads the nation in drought coverage for extreme or exceptional drought, 34%.
Rippey adds 17 states reported extreme and or exceptional drought to end the year.
Looking at our agriculture, commodities, and crops in drought for the end of 2024, a quick look at winter wheat. One quarter of the U.S. winter wheat production area in drought at the end of December. That is down from 29% at the beginning of December and way down from the autumn peak of 62% on October 29th. We see a similar pattern unfolding for our hay production area in drought and our cattle inventory in drought. U.S. hay production in drought, 36% at the end of December, down from 48% on December 3rd and 63% in late October. And then finally, U.S. cattle inventory in drought, just over a third, 34% on December 31st, down from 40% at the beginning of December and down from 62% in late October. So for the most part, heading the right direction, but we continue to watch some of that drought area stretching from the Southwest to the South Central United States, and also continuing to watch ongoing drought issues across the Northern Great Plains.
I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.
Thanks, Rod. And this is Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
What we're seeing with our clients, a lot of these provisions are going to increase the tax liability to farm families. And as Todd mentioned, our farm families can ill afford right now and any additional hits to the bottom line.
At a recent Farm Foundation event on taxes, Elizabeth Swanson with Pinion.
On the estate and gift tax exemptions, the IRS has said that less than 1% of individuals dying in the United States will be required to file a tax return, and even fewer required to actually pay estate tax. However, USDA statistics have shown that farmers are disproportionately impacted. Double the number of farmers will be required to file a tax return compared to the general population, and double the number of estates will owe tax. Kent covered as well that the NCBA study shows that nearly a third of their respondents have been affected in some way or will be affected in some way by the estate tax if the TCJA sunsets at the end of 2025. We are seeing very similar results with our clients and have concerns if the estate tax exemption is cut in half to inflation adjusted about $7 million per person in 2026. A lot of farm businesses that we work with are going to be impacted in a really tangible way. But even outside of that, just because you're below the estate tax exemption doesn't mean that you don't worry about it. So the impact of the estate tax is a lot larger than what the statistics would show about who really is filing estate tax returns and paying estate tax. On the qualified business income deduction, again, TIA's study is great at demonstrating that there's a significant impact of QBI on farm families. And we would add that farm businesses really rely on deductions that are passed through from cooperatives as well, which are not subject to the positive net income restrictions that Tia had mentioned. And so we see that the QBI deduction, because of cooperative activity, usually results in a significantly higher impact both to operations that are at a loss for tax purposes and also operations that are possibly a little bit lower in income that might otherwise be limited if the deduction were generated at the operation level rather than the co-op. So what we've seen is that the QBI deduction really is a larger impact than just a 20% deduction on our positive farm income. Additionally, we are focused on bonus depreciation. While Section 179 expensing is available, that also, like QBI, has some restrictions on positive net income in the trader business in order to take advantage of it, as well as some equipment value limitations for the year that they're placed in service. So bonus depreciation sunsetting is a concern, especially because Section 179 isn't really a one-for-one trade. Additionally, with commodities that are heavier on equipment, producers tend to use bonus depreciation year after year, so it's more than just a timing difference. The loss of bonus depreciation will be a really significant annual effect to many of the farmers that we work with. Additionally, the expiration of the reduced individual income tax rates and the expanded standard deduction will all affect, of course, the individual tax returns that we help clients work through as well.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
December 1, all hogs and pigs is at 75.8 million head, up 0.5% from previous years.
Travis Averill is chief of the livestock branch of the National Ag Statistics Service on the latest hogs and pigs report.
Inventory breeding hogs is at 6,004,000 head, an increase of 0.1% from 2023. Market hogs is at 69.8 million head, up 0.5% from last year. The top five states are listed in the bottom left-hand corner. Iowa leads the way at 24.6 million, though down 2% from 2023. Minnesota is in second at 9.5 million, up 2% from previous year. North Carolina is in that third at 8.2 million. That is an increase of 4% from last year. Illinois is in fourth at 5.6 million. They're also up 2% from 2023. And Indiana wraps up the top five states at 4.45 million, and they are down 1% from previous year. Market hogs is at 69.8 million. So let's look at the breakouts of the market hogs by weight groups. First, we have the less than 50 pound weight group is at 21.8 million head, up 1.2% from 2023. The 50 to 119 pound weight group is at 19.4 million, an increase of 1.4% from previous year. The 120 to 179 pound weight group is at 14.8 million, down six tenths of a percent from last year. The 180 pounds and over is at 13.8 million head, down 0.5% from 2023. Now we have the sales figure for September to November 2024. It's at 2,955,000 head. That's down 7,000 head from previous year. And so back in the September quarterly hogs and pigs report, the second intentions for the same quarter, September to November, was at 2,959,000 head, compared to the first intentions in the June quarterly hogs and pigs report of 2,945,000. So for the second intentions for December 2024 to February 2025, sows farrowing is at 2,930,000, up 1,000 from prior year's actual farrowings. And in the September quarterly hogs and pigs report, NAS had the first intentions for this quarter, quarterly sows at 2,933,000. So the first intentions for March to May of 2025, sows farrowing is at 2,953,000, up 40,000 head from previous year's actual farrowings. Pig crop weighing for September to November 2024 is at 35,238,000 head, an increase of 2% from previous year. This is a record for this for the September to November quarter for pig crop. In addition, the pig per litter weaned is at 11.92, up from the rate of 11.66 from last year, and up two tenths of a pig from previous quarter.
How did the report meet market expectations? Dr. Jason Franken, University of Missouri livestock economist.
The USDA's December hogs and pigs report places the December 1st inventory of all hogs and pigs at 75.8 million head, down 0.8% from last quarter, but up 0.5% from last year, compared to an average trade expectation of 0.2% higher. Market hogs mirrored the same expected and reported changes as total inventory, while the breeding herd is up just 0.1% over the prior year as expected. The main surprise is a record September to November pig crop, up more than 2% from a year ago and just above the upper end of the range of pre-report expectations, as a marginal cut in sows farrowed was more than offset by 11.92 pigs per litter, up more than 2% from last year's record for the period, continuing the upward trend in pigs per litter. While this level of productivity growth took the trade by surprise, in part because it's difficult to continually break records by large margins, further productivity growth is feasible, as Denmark is recently averaging around 15 pigs per litter.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
John Deere, great company. They announced about a year ago they're going to build big plants outside of the United States.
President-elect Donald Trump speaking before the election at the Economic Club of Chicago.
I said, if John Deere builds those plants and not selling anything into the United States, they just announced yesterday they're probably not going to build the plants, okay? I kept the jobs here, and I'll keep the John Deere will stay here. And I'll tell John Deere, if you do build outside of the United States, you can if you want. For instance, India is a very tough country. It's not only China. You know, China is the, I would say, probably the toughest. But there are a lot of tough. You know what's very tough? European Union. Our beautiful European countries, wonderful, wonderful. If you add them up, they're almost the size of us. They treat us so badly. We have a deficit. I said to Angela Merkel when she was there, she's not there anymore. I wonder why. But when she was there, I said, Angela, how many Chevrolets do we have in Berlin? Why, Donald, you have none. He said, that's right. How many Fords do we have in Frankfurt? I don't know. None. I said, that's right. You know how many cars we have? Mercedes-Benz, and BMW, and all of the Volkswagen. Millions and millions of cars. And then I said, farm products. You know, they don't want our farm. They don't want anything from us. We have deficits that are crazy, and we're not going to have them anymore. We're going to put tariffs on them, and they're going to do, and you know what they can do? The Mercedes-Benz will start building in the United States, and they have a little bit, but you know what they really are? Assembly, like in South Carolina. But they build everything in Germany, and then they assemble it here. They get away with murder because they say, oh, yes, we're building cars. They don't build cars. They take them out of a box and they assemble them. We could have our child do it. The tariff, you make it so high, so horrible, so obnoxious that they'll come right away. When I do the 10%, 10% is really, first of all, 10% when you collect it is hundreds of billions of dollars. The numbers that you're talking, all reducing our deficit. But really, so there's two ways of looking at a tariff. You can do it as a money-making instrument, or you can do it as something to get the companies. Now, if you want the companies to come in, the tariff has to be a lot higher than 10%, because 10% is not enough. Guys, they're not going to do it for 10. But you make a 50% tariff, they're going to come in. Let me tell you the other thing about tariffs that's great. China thinks we're a stupid country, a very stupid country. They can't believe that somebody finally got wise to them. Not one president, Bush, Obama, Barack Hussein Obama, have you heard of him? Not one president, not think of it, not one president charged China anything. They said, oh, they are a third world nation, they're a developing. Well, we're a developing nation, too. Take a look at Detroit. Take a look at our cities. We're a developing nation. We have to develop more than they do. We're way behind them. You take a look at what's happened to our cities. But our allies have taken advantage of us more so than our enemies.
But he also admits it's important to have exceptions available for both small and big business.
We have a very talented group of people. Bob Lighthizer did a very good job. We had great people. We had central casting. These are a great, and a large group of people. We made exceptions. In the case of Apple, they needed an exception. You know why? Because of Samsung. He came to me and he said, Samsung makes a product similar to ours, very good product, the phones and other things. And because they're in South Korea, they don't have the tariffs. Because we're in China, we have the tariffs. I said, you happen to be right. You're not going to be able to compete.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Congress doesn't really intend, at least that we've heard recently, to address tax provisions that have already expired that are negatively impacting farmers.
Elizabeth Swanson's with Pinion at a recent Farm Foundation Forum on tax policy.
The two really main ones that come to mind are the Section 174 Research and Experimentation provision. That provision was a special rule that expired in 2022 that said essentially that your research and experimentation previously could be currently deducted as if it were a regular business expense. After 2022, those expenses have to be capitalized and amortized or essentially depreciated over 5 years. There are a number of different businesses in the agricultural sector that do a lot of research and experimentation. And even those of us that feel like we don't also probably do, creating a bit of an IRS audit risk. So we're concerned with the likelihood that Congress won't eventually act to fix Section 174's expiration. Additionally, the TCJA has a limitation on interest expense deductions. Those deductions are limited to 30% of a business's taxable income. In 2022, the definition of taxable income changed so that businesses can't add back depreciation and amortization anymore, which means that the available deduction for interest expense is significantly lower. While there is a small business taxpayer exemption that says if your gross receipts are less than $25 million, you don't have to comply with this provision. And there's also an election out for larger farm businesses that could minimize the impact of the limitation, but that comes with a bonus depreciation trade-off. So we're concerned, especially for our larger livestock operations and larger row crop producing clients, that interest expense limitation is going to continue to have a pretty significant negative impact on tax liabilities. Additionally, we're worried about President-elect Trump's varied tax commitments and the distraction that those might provide to getting the TCJA extended. For example, of course, everyone is concerned about tariffs and the impact that those will have on American agriculture. Also concerned that his promises of reducing corporate tax rates will provide an additional distraction or negotiation point that will cause the extension to take a lot longer. the president-elect's commitment to eliminate income tax on tips, yet another provision that has to be drafted and has to be considered and negotiated. And then also the push to repeal the Inflation Reduction Act, including tax credits and incentives for clean energy, of course, affecting our corn growers and ethanol producers. And additionally, as I had mentioned before, that planned lack of retroactive effect can also be a big concern, especially as we're looking at those 10 provisions that are expiring here in 2024, and potentially the ones that are expiring in 2025, a fix only coming into effect on January 1 of 2026. So for the meantime, I think that the best thing that we can do is wait and see, and hope that, as Kent had indicated, the legislative process goes fairly quickly and Congress is able to kind of avoid all of those distractions that may prevent us from getting TCJA expansion done.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I think there are only four countries that are actually making traceable cotton in terms of independent individual bale identification numbers and fiber quality data.
Mark Misura is Senior Vice President of Cotton Incorporated.
The first, of course, is the U.S. The U.S. has outstanding information with the PBI, permanent bale identification. So the combination of a unique bale number and fiber quality information is really the gold standard worldwide for traceability. And the U.S. has it, and that's available with every bale. Other countries that are also marketing the bale ID and fiber quality information include Uzbekistan and Brazil. And Australia does it, but not, to my understanding, for every bale. So these are the four countries that are really trying to make the bale IDs and fiber quality information available. But that's really the level of traceability, the best level of traceability. For many countries around the world, traceability at farm level or even within a country doesn't exist because of the way cotton is collected. Farmers are paid for their seed cotton, paid on a weight basis, but that cotton often is commingled in the back of a truck or at the gin, and the identity's lost. So that's the reality for a lot of the world's cotton.
Traceability works when it's all cotton, but what happens when you put synthetic fibers in the mix?
We as a cotton industry have to make sure that if companies are blending cotton as part of a product, that cotton can come to the table and be transparent about how it's produced, where it comes from, so that the retailer, the brand, the product developer can have confidence in the cotton portion of that product. I think we also have to continue to argue for a level playing field so that if companies are required to be traceable, then let's make sure that cotton is held to the same standard that other fibers are. I certainly wouldn't want to see cotton held to a more detailed information standard, and farmers in the cotton supply chain held to a higher level of accountability than other fibers. I don't think that's fair. I don't think that's appropriate. But we have to make sure that cotton has that information available. We don't want to be ruled out because we don't have it. So that's our approach if cotton is used with other fibers, which is often the case.
And this debate over synthetic versus cotton fibers, not always an easy one at a global level.
One of the things, certainly when we talk about world cotton producers and world cotton consumers, some of the countries like India actually are also significant producers of synthetic fibers or fibers like rayon. So within these countries, they have significant interests in the synthetic side of the business, not only the cotton side. And this is true for China as well. So as I mentioned, just China and India account for half the world's milk consumption of cotton. But these two countries alone are also significant synthetic fiber producers and competitors with cotton. So when we talk about, you know, advancing the interest for world cotton or building coalitions to support cotton, some countries represented at a country level through organizations like the International Cotton Advisory Committee, for example, some countries actually are representing both interests. They don't have a clear predisposition toward cotton. They also have to be cognizant of their interests and synthetic manufacturing in their countries, which can be quite large and quite significant.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
So let's talk about what we know.
Elizabeth Swanson, National Tax Senior Manager with Pinion, at a recent Farm Foundation forum focusing on taxes.
Holistically, looking really statistically at farm businesses across the country, and we've found that the USDA report that Tia authored really is helpful in understanding all of the various impacts of globally what farm businesses in the United States are going to experience with the expiration of the TCJA. We know going into 2025 that stakes are high. So we have 10 tax provisions that are expiring at the end of 2024, an additional 30 provisions that are expiring at the end of 2025, with a further 4 tax provisions that are international business focused that are also expiring at the end of 2025.